The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, John gets excited about pre-crime. Jennifer investigates Wall Street and AT&T. Roger spins his magic. What a tangled web we weave. And a new pitch only needs money to grow faster, and much, much more, only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Welcome, Dennis. Tell us the name of your company and what it does.
My name is, again, Dennis Dicker. My company's Optonomy, like autonomy. Combine two words, optimum autonomy. And it's a mobile application that's consumer friendly, but at the core of it, it helps clinicians start and scale their own home healthcare businesses, supporting adults with autism.
Hey, hang on, let's just start at the basics. When you say you have an app,
yes.
Okay, apps were something that were a big deal a couple of years ago, and these days everybody has an app, and it's, you know, so what?
Right.
So the question is, you know, what's the problem that you solve?
Sure. So it started about 2013 when I was running my own home healthcare business. And at the time, I needed to properly remotely manage care workers out in the community. So
wait a minute. Wait, what business did you run?
My own home healthcare agency. So I started building autonomy while running my own
home. No. Let me get back. Your own health. What is your own home healthcare agency? What is that?
Sure. So at the time, I launched it in 2013. It was an agency approved and licensed through Medicaid to support adults with autism and intellectual disabilities.
So you were helping adult autistic people, and in what way did you help them? What is it that your agency did?
I did many things. Because I'm a real estate investor, I set up a home and got it licensed through Medicaid so someone can transition out of a hospital type setting to live in a home close to their family, for example. Many individuals with behavioral needs need long-term care, and many of their behaviors, they can't be handled unless it's in a lockdown hospital-type setting. With autonomy, we put in the right supervision so that someone can live in a community home, a regular home.
That's very interesting. Okay, so in your agency, what was the problem? Why did you...
I had over 70 staff, and they were all over the eastern Pennsylvania. And there was no way I could go right there in person, but I wanted to make sure that there was no abuse, neglect, or fraud going on. So that's when we started to build out autonomy and focus on electronic visit verification. It's a nationwide.
Right, so hang on, you keep rushing ahead here.
Okay.
So where in Pennsylvania were you?
We started in Philadelphia, which is one of the highest areas in Pennsylvania that has adults with special needs.
Yeah, I ask you because I grew up in Pittsburgh.
Yes, Pittsburgh is the area, yes.
Yeah, so do you also have places in Pittsburgh?
There are providers in the...
No. Did you have people in Pittsburgh?
We have... Autonomy has customers in Pittsburgh, yes. It was just local counties. So it's Philadelphia, yeah. Montgomery.
Right, so now... You talk about verification that the people actually go to visit the site, right? And presumably they have it on their cell phones. So when they go visit the site, they check in and say, here I am. And they use the camera to take pictures and say, you know, that kind of stuff. Or how do you do that verification of visit?
Sure. So on the back end, it actually connects directly to Medicaid. Again, it's a mandatory requirement now. When I did it, it wasn't mandatory. I did it because I needed it. But now it's being enforced on all providers, and autonomy is one of the few software solutions that connects directly with Medicaid for billing purposes.
No, so, but again, back to my question, how do you verify somebody actually made the visit?
Sure, with GPS, as well as, so you schedule them, and then with GPS within the application, there's a requirement that you actually have to be at that location.
So when you're on site, you open the application, say, here I am. Yeah. And then do they have to take pictures or something like that to show that the facility is clean and, you know, something like that, or what?
Sure. So the autonomy application allows them to, or the provider, to customize whatever they're looking for the staff to do. And they are, those forms are, can be customized in the application and pushed out at specific times or locations where they have to fill it out. So they receive these updates and they pretty much automate it. So on a day-to-day basis, they can focus on other things like, okay, I want to enhance this service here, enhance this service here.
Interesting. Okay. So presumably this is a growing business, right? It's not something that is running out of your garage, or is it?
No, there are way too many customers out there. There's also a waiting list of the people waiting.
you mean you have customers waiting and you can't onboard them?
Oh, so as far as clinicians that are using autonomy or getting started to start their business using autonomy, yes, we do have a backlog while we were building out the automation side. So we currently have about 100 clinicians that are about to start and scale their business. They're under contract.
So how many are using it today?
They're all using it. We can do a conference.
So you have 100 using it today?
Over 100.
Over 100. And how many are in line to have it as soon as they can?
As far as the opportunity, there are thousands of millions of clinicians out there.
No, that's the potential market. I'm talking about people that are actually waiting to sign up and you can't sign them up for some reason.
Oh, no, those that sign up, they sign up.
Okay, they're signed up. All right. So, yeah. So, and the whole thing works at this point, right? So yes. All you need is what, money to sell and market, right?
That's it. We actually haven't, like, we could bring on 1,000 users, but we want to have the right team in place to really make it successful. Because we've done it on a small scale. We have over 150, but we're trying to get to 1,000 to 5,000 type
provider. There you go. Interesting. All right. So a company looking to grow, and you're using cyber for efficiency, for the technology ability to track things, and the cell phone is a critical component of it because that gives you location and pictures and other recording capabilities, as well as the ability to fill out the forms, right? And then my understanding is also they enter what they did and that automatically does the billing and they can automatically get paid, right?
Yes, and they do all that remotely, even the business office.
Yeah, and this includes the formation of their business, right? Because it's one thing to be a provider. It's another one to create your LLC or whatever business you're going to create and do all the paperwork for that. So that's all done too, right?
Correct. So one thing that we didn't really talk about was the learning management system that was built in. We actually have a built-in learning management system that we can customize to our liking. We actually have a clinician who just recently finished a training that we're adding to the system. So we have them going through trainings as their business is being approved. And then their staff also goes through the application through the mobile phone for training as well.
There you go. All right. So basically, soup to nuts, I'm a provider. I want a business. You provide everything except being the provider, right?
Right. I want to make it as easy as possible for them so they can focus.
Makes perfect sense.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Pulling double. Papers flying. Everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch, and to view their gee-whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show.
The internet seems to be slowing down. I suspect it might be part of an ongoing infrastructure attack.
Thank goodness this show is on the radio, because otherwise it would be breaking news on The Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the 5 ways we know today. 1, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio.
3, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
We were talking about, you looked at the University of Virginia shooting.
Well, I did 2 of them. That was one of them.
And every indicator you could imagine was there, right? I mean, you could not think of an indicator they didn't have in advance.
Right. I mean, there was, in the University of Virginia case, there was no missing information. There was nothing found in the final forensic analysis and investigations that wasn't already known.
Before the event took place.
Before the event took place.
Yeah, but the problem is, what do you do about it?
Well, shooting some of them would have helped, but I don't think... what you do about it like that is you're supposed to try and fix those holes. You're supposed to try and that was such a political nightmare. I mean, we actually had laws in many states that says you can't do that, right? I mean, mental illness was then and continues to be now a major hole in our armor to defend against violent behavior. Now,
so we use cyber systems to detect all sorts of things, postings on the internet, behavior to correlate the information that's available and so forth. But if we had a cyber system that was flashing red and saying, this person has every conceivable indicator that says they're going to go shoot somebody tomorrow morning, it doesn't change anything because you can't do anything about it. There's no pre-crime, you know, unless they did something illegal beforehand. You just have to wait till they start shooting, right?
Well, we suffer as a society. We suffer from this issue that legally is called probable cause. And probable cause, legally, the decision on probable cause can only be made by a judge. Now, police officers can assert they had probable cause because of this, but they won't find out whether the judge agrees or not until they present and get the warrant, right? And oftentimes, when you're reacting to some kind of anomalous detection, you don't know how much time you have, so you haven't got time to enter into a 3-week conversation with some judge someplace talking about probable cause. And that's the dilemma that enforcers have from, or protectors, if you will, have from protecting someone who's being threatened.
Well, but it's not just somebody that's specifically threatened, right? I mean, right now we have, you know, judges and prosecutors and people that run pizza shops being threatened, but no protective order is going to save them because the threat isn't localized to a specific actor at a specific time taking some specific act. And you can't have a generic protection mechanism. There just is no such thing. So what do you do in a society to try to counter? What is the, suppose again that we have the information, right? We've done the analysis. We've gotten the information from all the sensors. We have everything we need to say that this person is likely, we don't know how likely, but we believe this person's going to act in a relatively short time frame to do harm, great bodily harm, but we don't know where and when and who. So what are we ever going to be able to do about that?
I wish I had that answer, Fred. Here's one of the issues that perplexes everybody in who considers this kind of thing. There's an old intelligence doctrine that says when you seek to understand an entity, be that a person, a business, a country, whatever, threat status, you know, that stool has four legs on it. And the first leg is, do they have the capability to carry out their threat, right? That's one of the legs, not necessarily the most important one.
But capabilities, intent, yeah. Another one.
Right. Have they asserted an intent? So what's their intent? Have they identified a target community? Now, that could be a country, that could be a person, that could be, whatever. And then finally, when you consider those elements, is it actionable intelligence? Do you have enough information to take action?
Yeah, and that's the problem, right, is that action threshold is poorly defined. There's no standard operating procedure. There's no predefined acceptable mechanism for when to act. It's all left up to the discretion of somebody in the circumstance. And, of course, they're potentially to blame if they act when they should not have acted. And if they fail to act, they're, you know, blamed for not acting, right?
Do you remember some years ago there was an activist attack at the front gate of CIA headquarters in Langley. And several exiting employees were killed. A couple of the security personnel at the gate were killed. At that time, I was teaching a couple of classes under a DOJ contract, who was forming all of these, what they were calling at the time as these conversion centers, these multi-agency assessment centers in the FBI and, you know, all the various law enforcement agents. So I taught a class probably 20, 25 times that was titled The Introduction to the Intelligence Community, because a lot of these people had never, I mean, they knew a little bit about national security, but and usually the class out of 25, there was probably 10 Department of Justice lawyers there, and then there would be other law enforcement type folks and prosecutors and things like that. And the question that always came up was, why didn't the CIA have law enforcement authority?
They're not allowed to do that in the United States. There's legal bars, right?
Oh, no. They're authorized to protect their property. They're authorized to enforce laws on their property. But they never accepted the DOJ authority to have law enforcement. You can't just say, okay, I'll buy badges and we'll do that. You have to have a provision by Congress that grants authority to your agency to have law enforcement. And there's 7 degrees of law enforcement. So the point was, these guys would always, the gals would ask that question. I said, look, what is the reason that law enforcement oftentimes misses the opportunity to collect valuable information? Single reason, because you have to get a warrant to, all the guy has to do is say, I want to talk to my lawyer, and interrogation stop. And they, you know, all of that kind of stuff. The agency never wanted law enforcement authority because we don't care about prosecuting anyone. We're interested in receiving information.
So this is because it's not about prosecution, it's about intelligence, and it's a different function, right?
Well, that's the only purpose of law enforcement.
No, I understand. That's why they don't want that authority, because that's not their function.
Right.
Right. So now there's this one other thing here. So this is the methodology that's used for things like nuclear weapons. It's indications and warnings, right? It's also used in the military, right? So you have a set of indications that trigger a warning. So you sort of have a, we'll call it a programmed decision process, where if you see these things happening in this sequence and in that amount, whatever the deal is, the decision process says, oh, this looks like one of those. You need to warn the target or the potential target. They get the warning, and it's up to the person who's in charge of that base or whatever that activity is to, on that warning, act reasonably and prudently to protect, right?
Yep.
So we don't seem to have developed an indications and warnings-like mechanism for anything except for these extremely high-consequence situations, and in the military, it's a standard procedure. But that doesn't seem to exist in the rest of society.
Well, truth be known, if nuclear weapons were to be the target of something, there is no one from the president down in the governmental architecture that would argue about what should be done. They would, in fact, they would try and stay out of being involved in the decision making. You execute whatever the plan is, right?
Right. That's because that's a program decision.
Yeah, but the problem is, aside from nuclear weapons, what's the next one?
Chemical and biological would be the next, but that's not treated in the same way.
It isn't, and you don't have a consolidation of agreement.
Well, and frankly, you don't have the level of consequence.
Well, see, that's the problem. When you say my job is to stop this thing from happening, and I propose to do this, there's not very many things that we can't stop if we want to put enough effort into it. But that effort comes at a price. All security comes at a price, and everyone focuses on the dollars and cents of the cost. But frankly, the no's from the command level usually are not because of dollars and cents. That's the excuse they use, but it comes from opinions.
So let's then talk about that. That generally goes into what we call risk management.
Go back to the beginning of that conversation, right? And we're talking really about, you know, actions right of boom, right? As you guys were saying, you know, legally we can't use, you know, law enforcement to prevent people from doing things, even if it's, you know, extremely likely that they're going to do them in an open system. Now, in an authoritarian system, you do, but
there are cases where you can actually do it in the United States. But the problem is, so the University of Virginia shooting, you know, which I know a little bit more about, that whole incident, and I know more because I talked to John about it at length over the years, they were actually doing things about it. This person was in a mental institution for a period of time. He was detained for a period. There are all sorts of things like that that happened before. And that's part of that history that John talks about that was there, right? So, you know, it's not like we didn't know. Right? In fact, what he said was, when they did all the forensics after the fact, they found no information they didn't know, you know, left of boom before it happened. Right. So, and there is a methodology for doing that, but they didn't execute on that methodology because it didn't get over an action threshold by an actor that was capable of doing anything. And the problem here is we don't have standard operating procedures that say when it hits this threshold, do that thing. It's all discretionary. That's a lot of what the problem is that we face.
Well, right. You know, and the point that really stuck with me on this one is that right and left of boom. And Fred and I are quoting the great Tim Roxy, right? You know, the fact that lights are on is in part due to this right and left of boom thought process that Tim inserted into the cybersecurity for electric grids. And it's, you know, mapping these cyber things to the social things or the social things to the cyber things. That left of boom is how you keep this from happening, right? You know, so just like with machines, we can't make them perfect, and we don't really, really know if they're going to go bad until they go bad. Same thing with people, as you're saying, Fred. So this individual was already getting some treatment. Obviously, that didn't work. You know, so we can work more to the right of boom. What do we do when this happens? But, you know, that always goes in balance with left of boom. There's just as much work to do on how do we somehow, you know, people don't like doing this. This wasn't a good day for this individual. Their mind went nuts, right? And they died, right? So it's possible to fix the computer or the person. It's just not easy. And we need to keep working that side. And then right of boom is a thing. You know, law enforcement is in response, and whether cyber or human is a thing.
So in many ways, this comes down to sort of the fundamental overarching problem in cybersecurity and in every other kind of security, that you would like to not have bad things happen. You put mechanisms in place to interdict, you can prevent, you can detect and react, you can adapt. And the adaptation is the thing we're talking about. That adapt part is how do we change things now to make it so in the future we've prevented or interdicted and so forth. And that's the feedback loop of cybersecurity, the outer OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, act from the Boyd. It's called the Boyd cycle from a pilot last name Boyd that came up with it for how you, he's a fighter pilot, how you deal with fighting as a fighter pilot, not in a under boxing ring. But the challenge is eternal in that the threat keeps changing, the activities keep changing, the targets keep changing, everything keeps changing. And the cybersecurity job is to anticipate and constrain this stuff to within the boundaries that the entity dictates. And this is what risk management is all about, right? Model-based situation anticipation and constraint is what I talk about when I describe this, right? So we have models in our heads or as groups, we have models, we have automated models, and we're trying to anticipate what's going to happen and constrain it to the desired futures. Part of the problem is just the amount of thought process it takes to do that. And when you listen to John talk about this, the words he used, the methodologies he talks about, these are not things he just pops off the top of his head. He didn't read a book. Right. These are things, and we've been discussing these things. I've been discussing these things with him for years. And he's on all these panels and government and large group meetings where they talk through these things and after action reports. And they come up with these overarching structures of how it works and why it works. And they put words on them. This indications and warnings thing is a great example for nuclear stuff, nuclear weapons hitting the United States. We have indications and warnings and systems of defenses that are programmed responses because you can't do anything else in that time frame with that consequence. So there's an enormous amount of time and effort for that because the consequence is so high. And this comes back to consequence-based analysis, which is something we've been talking about forever. So now tell us about that.
Well, right. You know, and people have to remember, we're never trying to drive risk to zero. One of my abiding themes in my life is we're living in a period where our risk is historically, individually, you know, so incredibly low, certainly in the first world, compared to a few generations ago in all of human history. We have to start deciding, do we want to drive it to zero? Because as John said, we can stop almost anything. You know, a nation can stop almost anything from happening. You just pay more and more in other costs. And it's not dollars, it's liberties. You know, an authoritarian structure can prevent things by happening, you know, get all dystopian and THX 1138, right? That actually works, but it's not the goal. You know, zero isn't the goal. We need to define what it is and then work to that.
There is that part of it. If you look at what's happening right now with AI, I think AI is a fabulous place to look at this because it's an emerging technology that is surprising a lot of people, and especially at the level of first glance. When you start to delve into it, when you start to dig into it, somebody that knows what they're doing in a subject area finds out that it's ridiculous. It's not very intelligent, but it sounds good. And that's the problem, right? The vast majority of the population sounds good is as good as it gets. And so it's able to make almost anything sound good. So then that's leading down the path to 50%+ of CEOs are now declaring that the consequences of AI could be the end of humanity in the next 10 years, which I think is ridiculous, overblown, and so forth. But I think the consequence of stupidity certainly can achieve it. Right? The lack of attention to details by the CEOs, by 50%+ of the CEOs, can certainly cause dramatic global downturns and so forth. So now Europe is coming up with laws, and the European Union has some fabulous ideas around these laws they're coming up with. And for the first time ever in my seeing it, I'm seeing the European Union is taking a consequence-based, not risk, consequence-based. What they're saying is, they call it risk, but for the high consequence stuff, they're saying a lot of controls. So they have multiple levels of consequence, and at the low consequence level, there's almost no control. So you and I want to experiment with AI for something. Oh, go ahead. Who cares? On the other hand, if a major media outlet decides, or if the judges in all of the courts in the land decide to use AI to replace themselves, now that's the high consequence. Anything involving war. So this approach that's consequence-based, now they're talking about the generative AI, but generally this should apply to all technology. And in fact, all aspects of human behavior that you're going to deal with by government. It's about consequence. Now, you look at shootings in the United States as another area of risk, right? Shootings in the rest of the world, you know, even in war zones, are less than the United States. So the consequence gets high enough, and now you have the Second Amendment that says, you know, you have the right to bear arms. Well, actually, it doesn't say that, but that's how it's been ruled on. It's what it says, you can have a well-armed militia, which we already have in National Guards and in other similar things, but we'll just ignore that because the Supreme Court decided that that didn't matter. We were going to do it anyway. So now you have all these people with the so-called right to bear arms, and you're pushing the threshold where they're trying to ban some class of weapons, and people act like that's insane. Well, of course, the consequences are getting so high. There's mass shootings like every day in the United States now, I think, something like that. More than the number of days so far in the year, mass shootings in the United States. But the other side of it is nobody seems to argue that you should be restricting, oh, you know, grenade launchers, nuclear weapons, and so bioweapons. So there are restrictions against bearing arms that are already there.
Let me take the bait on that one because it's a contentious issue. But on this one, you know, I believe in the right to self-defense. I don't necessarily think that firearms are that useful. I mean, but they are. Yeah, happy days. Go for you.
Just for clarity, Chris, I completely agree. You have the right to self-defense.
Right. So I think the analogy here, you know, into cyber and business and so forth is, you know, the goal is self-defense. You know, the means, you know, we here in the U.S., we have the Second Amendment and firearms and so forth, which in the span of time are, you know, mildly evolved blow dart guns where we have some powder, we, you know, stuff in the end of them. And we're on a timeline and living in a world where the policies, you know, we want to create should work if when everyone has autonomous cyber personal defense systems with nanobots with, you know, capacitors in them that'll tase the ass of everybody. You know, the goal is self-defense.
We get into the region of cyber, getting back to cyber. The question is, are you allowed to attack back? Right? Because there's a lot of policy and a lot of technology surrounding cyber defenses that involve not just sitting there taking it. But okay, if I see that there's an IP at internet protocol address attacking me, or there's an email address and doing something bad or whatever, I can go and attack back. So there's the attribution problem. You need to be able to attribute actions to actors. And then the self-defense, that when it becomes aggressive, becomes something where you're going to hurt them before they hurt you or interdict or whatever. So these active, offensive defense tactics are against the law, right? It's called vigilantism, and vigilantism is basically against the law everywhere. But what we're getting is vigilantism, and we get that on the internet because companies don't have any other alternative, realistically.
Well, it's we're getting this deep into it, right? You know, the what's happening in software supply chain, right, security right now. I continue to believe, and you know, even so, this week I was in Los Angeles with Department of Homeland Security with the S-bomberama there. It was a fantastic, you know, conversation about information sharing and integrity, basically, right? And just, you know, as part of a working group, you know, of two dozen of the best folks in the world, just talking about these things. And where we are right now is we're actually hitting some interesting walls that I'm, you know, too nerdy to get into right here. But I think to our purpose, you know, we have to engineer for business and technical purposes these technical systems that will allow multiple parties, whoever they are, to share information and know the information is at least from who it was. You talk about identity and naming and so forth, and something, right? You know, and I believe that over, you know, medium terms and measured in decades, this applies to all information.
Roger Royce is one of the most well-known and well-positioned attorneys working on cyber issues, particularly in the ag tech arena, but also in many other areas. He also has a tremendous understanding of influence and related issues, as we'll see in our discussions.
This is introducing Roger. Roger is a lawyer from many, many years. And among the other things Roger has done, he's been very important in the cyber arena and very, very important focused on the ag tech arena for many years, as well as other areas. And he's helped got to be thousands of startups get started and done a lot of legal work and licensing. And he has several recordings on the cybershow.co that you can listen to if you want all the details that I will disagree with when I try to sell you something that we have. So with that, say hello, Roger.
Yeah. Yep. Hello, Fred. Good to see you.
All right. That wasn't hello, Roger. That was hello, Fred.
All right. Hello, Roger.
There you go. All right.
This is an odd show, but okay.
No worries. So, Roger, start at the beginning. How did you end up becoming a lawyer? What did you do in the early part of your life and career that got you to there? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I've known I wanted to be a lawyer since I was about 12, I think. And my father, he was a small businessman, and I tell this story a lot. I just noticed that whenever there was any, in a small town, whenever there was any sort of issue, any sort of business issue, he'd have to go talk to a lawyer. If he had a contract that needed to be divined, you know, we talked to a lawyer. The lawyers, to me, seemed like shamans. They were magicians. They had all the answers. They could make things happen. So that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do.
They knew all the magic tricks.
Right.
So as a magician, I don't know if you know this, I am also a magician. I do magic tricks, and I learned how to do this as part of my work in understanding influence operations and deception and counter deception, and used to teach it to students in class and so forth. And they would have to figure out how I did the trick, or at least a plausible way to do the trick in order to get it, you know, pass a test, for example. So you're a different kind of magician. So tell us about your magician qualities as a lawyer. What makes you a magician?
Well, by magician, I mean a lot of things by that. When I think of magic, I think of psychic influence, right?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Psychic influence, the ability to influence people and or events. And that's what lawyers do. We influence, right? We influence for a living. We persuade for a living. So that's the magic part of this, is to make things happen through influence. The part that originally appealed to me was just understanding the language of that. Law is the language of business, right? Or at least that's what I thought when I was younger, because these contracts made no sense unless you were a lawyer to try to read them. I later decided, well, law.
Hang on, don't rush off here. So if that's true, how do you ever get the meeting of the minds? Right. I thought the whole point of a contract is it's the meeting of minds between the parties. And if neither of them understand what it says, how can they agree?
Well, that's why you need lawyers to explain it and understand it. And by the way, when I say people don't understand what it says, let's just say that the language tends to be very technical. It's hard to read. It's not easy to read because it's precise. It has to be very precise. And that's what lawyers are good at doing. And if like my contracts, the things I draft, if we end up in litigation, it's because the language was not precise, and I failed if this ends up being litigated. I want to avoid that result and keep costs down and make sure everybody understands exactly what it is that they're doing.
So that's a fantastic statement, and I don't think I buy into it. So I've been in litigation where there was no contract, you know, issue of what the contract says. It was just that, you know, one CEO is mad at another one, and they both had money. I'm going to sue you because I hate you. And those are the ones that tend to go to trial, because almost anything else will reasonably settle long before then, right?
Yeah. And honestly, I know it doesn't seem like, but that's the rare case. I mean, normally people know, we know what the law is. We've got a good idea of the facts. We all have a good idea of who's got the better, you know, who's got the better argument. If something goes to trial, that's the minority. That's where you get in that case where it's just too close to call and people are willing to roll the dice. Because litigation is a roll of the dice. It's one way of looking at it. The way I mostly look at it is that it's another negotiation tool, right? A lot of times people will go to the brink of litigation just as a negotiation tool, because that's what I do, is I negotiate for a living. And it's a tool. It's like a nuclear weapon. It's like a tool I don't ever want to have to use. You know, but we have to have it in reserve just to let people know we're a credible threat.
Okay. So your description of what you do is increasingly sounding like somebody in the, what I think one of our other guests called offensive security.
Hey, no, I'm a happy event lawyer. You know, I don't sue people. You know, I build companies. I don't tear them down. We put things together, but I want to put things together in a way that they're going to be sustainable. I don't want to see people make legal mistakes. I don't want them to create ambiguities. I don't want them to do things that are just going to cause problems down the road. So I like to highlight what those problems might be, so we know what it is we're trying to avoid.
Yeah, but then it's up to your client, right? The client gets the final decision. So if they want ambiguity, they're going to get it, right?
Right. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it's good to be passive aggressive, I guess. Sometimes ambiguity works in your favor, you know, and you see that sometimes where if, you know, if the ambiguity works in your favor, then maybe you won't do anything about it. I hate to draft that way, but I've seen that happen.
Yeah, well, you've read some of my draft agreements and you know what I do, which we're not going to discuss on the show because it's not about me, it's about you.
Like a lot of cliches, you know, this one has a lot of truth to it, right? You know, good fences make good neighbors, right? And this is why I like contracts. I like policy because what we're trying to do is agree. You know, we're defining what our relationship is. You know, okay, you know, we're doing it for these reasons and in these conditions, you know, we'll do these things. Where, you know, it also, in my experience, you know, falls apart is when you make an endless risk hunt. You know, another clause. Wait, you know, let's figure this out. Let's figure, you know, what if this, you know, define what your relationship is going to be and execute on that, you know, transparently, better, faster, cheaper.
I just like the fact that one of the first things out of his mouth was that, you know, his job is as an influence operator. You know, that's, you know, you talk about, you know, people who are experts in deception and perception and influence. Well, that's his job. And he sees all of it as that. He's like, no, it's not about some rules. It's about causing people to not do stupid things.
Right. You know, I look at in the early 2000s, did a Silicon Valley startup, and we engaged, you know, the top, you know, legal, you know, Silicon Valley legal firm, and got, you know, draft agreements and contracts put together, and got our first, you know, partners, you know, signed up, and we went back and forth on some of the wording in the contracts, and it was, you know, fascinating for me because it's like, oh, you know, that, yeah, I can't remember what it was and doesn't make any difference. So that clause, that if this happens and this happens, actually that's a real concern. All right, you know, we'll put this clause in to fix it. And then we did the second, the third, and the fourth, and fifth, and the sixth, and seventh, and eighth, you know, so forth, other partnerships. And in each case, the next round of lawyers identified another risk that we had to have, you know, clause text around. You know, it made me wonder that whether every single version of these agreements, other than the last one, was wrong. Because by definition, it was not covering all sorts of risks. And to your point, you know, I agree. I think the lawyer, you know, it's an influence operation to create comfort. And if the comfort is, look, I stepped up for you and identified another risk and put another safety valve in, maybe that's it. It's not about identifying all the risks and putting all the safety valves in. It's about making you comfortable enough to go ahead with a relationship.
So, you know, I have had from time to time contract disputes, and my contracts have, some people will say, bizarre components. I think I have one lawyer who says, I've never seen this in a contract before, and I don't believe it's ever been litigated. For them, that's a bad thing. For me, that's a good thing, because the number one and only sole purpose of me to write a contract is to avoid any sort of litigation whatsoever. I never, ever, ever want to go to court because I've done a lot of expert witness work. And man, you do not want to do that. It's expensive. It's time consuming. It's a brain drain. It's a royal pain. And like he said, it's a crapshoot. It's a flip of the coin, whether you win or lose. It has nothing to do with how good your case is. All that stuff is what you do before the trial. So look at this huge thing against Fox News, right? What, $680 some billion, right? That was the settlement, okay, because even they knew, even for 600 however many billion dollars, it was too risky to have that thing in court, because they knew, for example, that everything that people would be forced to tell the truth about would be so damaging to them that it would be worse than the 600 some odd billion, and they could get dinged for twice that or four times that, you know, so, you know, that was compelling. So I think that's a tremendous influence operation, right, by the lawyers in that case. So there's just so much truth in what he says. And, you know, people think that this stuff doesn't apply to cyber, but I've seen a lot of people try to automate the legal process. A lot of people trying to, you know, do automated analysis on contracts and so forth. And I think the lawyers that I know that it's a people issue. It's not a rule issue, right? And the testimony, it's all about credibility of one person to another. You sit up on the stand and you say what you're going to say, and people have a sense when you're BSing them, when you are, you know, shifting around in your chair and so forth. So the other side of that is there are people that are educated and trained and professional at not wiggling in their chair or blinking their eyes too much when they lie.
Right.
And they may be the best expert witnesses ever. Except influence operations is what lawyers are fantastic at. And if we're going to counter influence operations in the cyber world, we need to start to understand things the way lawyers understand them. And one of the fundamentals to that is to recognize that very few lawyers start out in the technical field and become lawyers. Almost all lawyers start out in non-technical. You know, they're English majors, you know, social studies, psychology, and they go to law school. And those are the fundamental skills you need. And by the way, most of the people in Congress are also lawyers. And those are the skills they have. They're people skills. That's how you get elected, right?
Well, I think the technical, you know, one of my favorite issues right now, mostly because of it, I think I'm way too far ahead of the curve on this one, is making contracts into technical policy automatically. You know, you write a contract and, you know, that defines some relationship you have with another entity, and automated systems, oracles in your corporate environment, are literally reading that contract document and making technical policy out of it and implementing it in your information system, right? You know, that, you know, you have promised to share or not share this information. You know, you know, it's not about an auditor going back and checking everybody's emails. It's that that contract defines your relationship. That should be automatically read by automated systems and turned into technical rules that are then audited regularly. You know, we have a lot of people doing hand work, right? But again, in the ChatGPT world, you know, you can point ChatGPT at this and say, find everything that matches, and it'll come back right away. Or you can turn to some interns and say the same thing, and you know, after 180 hours of human work, you get one answer. So anyways.
All right, well, I will tell you that I mean, you keep talking about ChatGPT as if it's a wonder, and I think you're talking more generically about the concept behind it. But we're nowhere near meeting that concept behind it, or that illusion that people think of it.
Right.
It is not what you think it is. I know you know what it is, but you also know that
it's not artificial and it's not intelligent. It actually is what it is, and so that's not intelligent.
Well, the people out in radio land may misinterpret you.
Yes.
So I'm just cautioning them. Don't believe anything you hear here. Oh, which reminds me, deep fakes. Oh. We'll get back to this.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking here with Jennifer Bayuk. Jennifer was one of the first chief information security officers on Wall Street and has a long and storied career before and after that. So Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you, Fred. Nice to be here.
We were talking last time and we were talking about AI and all this stuff, but we got off track of your history and evolution. So you were working at AT&T and you ended up transferred to the security team because of an incident and ended up doing basically AI, the early, you know, that version of AI for cybersecurity, for intrusion and presumably anomaly detection and other such stuff. So then what happened next? Because I know you didn't stay at AT&T.
Well, I was conscripted by corporate security to help in investigations because I knew the security of the public with switch phone network and they had to investigate it and they only knew about PCs and office equipment. So I would.
Yeah. So their security department didn't know about their network. They only knew about the things that they bought from outside. Okay.
Exactly.
Not an unusual circumstance for security departments, by the way, right?
Well, that was, you know, the security department didn't come from Bell Labs. It was corporate AT&T, and they were actually the same department with internal audit. It was corporate security and internal audit in the same group back then.
Okay, so hang on. That's much better than what you normally found, was that the physical security was aligned with corporate security. So being part of internal audit at least gave you, you know, the notion of what was going on financially and informationally and so forth.
It was a network company. That's all they had was the phone network. So that didn't surprise me. I did spend time helping them with investigations. And then I accepted a rotation into internal audit because it was like a management move. At Bell Labs at the time, they were trying to, you know, separate technology career path from management career path. Management had an extra week's vacation, you know, all this stuff the technologists were kind of left behind.
So you went for the pay and the benefits.
So I did. And I found out after being in internal audit for maybe 4 to 6 months that the internal audit at large companies like AT&T were ripe for the pickings by the big six who needed to get consultants and auditors for themselves. And I got recruited out by Pricewaterhouse. And, you know, that was the beginning of really real money, not just technology.
All right, so let's just talk about that, because as a woman, presumably you were historically underpaid compared to comparable men. Mm-hmm. And when you got hired away, that was a big boost in pay. Were you then paid comparably to other men in that position, or you were still underpaid?
I was still underpaid. That just goes with the territory.
Well, I feel as if that's an injustice that should be cured. But regardless, when you went out, you got a much bigger pay than you were getting at AT&T. So, you know, it certainly is better. Yeah. So they got top quality for cheap. Mm-hmm. All right. So what did you do then for them?
I did audits and investigations for clients in multiple industries, financial, pharmaceutical, you know, anything that was in the New Jersey, New York area. So I looked at networks for Chase Bank, for example, back then, and international flavors and fragrances. And, you know, it was very fascinating how they protected the secrets of making a flavor or a fragrance, things like that. So
now this wasn't financial audit. This was what, IT audit, or what was what part of audit was this called?
When it was an audit, it was part of the financial audit supporting the integrity decisions on whether the financial statements were correct and whether the going concern could be relied upon. Were there material weaknesses in the products and services being offered? You know, in banks, it was fundamental to keeping the money safe, that the computers were working properly, that they were secured. In fact, the banks were the only, the banks and Coca-Cola and international flavors and fragrances, people with real technology, I mean, real intellectual property trade secrets. Those two industries were where I was assigned to work in Pricewaterhouse for the most part.
Yeah. And those trade secrets were presumably extremely valuable then and as they are now. So basically these became material, although I guess they didn't call it material then. That was something that SOX really pushed heavily, but they were material to the success of the company. So that's why you went after them. So when you went after that protection, was it just the IT side, or was it the physical security and everything else, or what was it?
It was the physical security and everything else. I remember going to a data center in Colorado in the middle of the night and seeing the back door wide open and just to let the air in. It was so we did things like that. As one of my colleagues said in a conference, we are not above dumpster diving.
No, of course not. And so presumably you were also doing physical break-ins. We'll call it red teaming now or something like that.
But
the cigarettes outside the door, the dead giveaway, right?
Yes, the smoking circle was the place to be to find out what was going on. Yeah.
Well, and to follow them back in.
Of course, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, so
tailgating and you put in hardware subversions. You know, you'd go in and plug something into the network and so forth, right?
Right. And you didn't even need to plug too much in. You just needed to be a node on the network on one of their own computers. And I remember these people who had just picked up on Nessus scanning and things that got hired in a little bit after me, and they would spend all of their time scanning the network looking for vulnerabilities. And I'm like, well, you know, I can see the mainframe traffic right on my port, and I can read all of the email that has the usernames and passwords in it. What do you need a vulnerability for? You don't need one.
Yeah, right. Just wait and watch. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's what we did. We did that a lot for some of the large companies. But by the time I moved out, you know, to the Bay Area, San Francisco, You know, we were going into these high-rise buildings for, you know, many, you know, billions and billions of dollars. So let me just ask you, quick question, what's the biggest amount of money you were able to demonstrate the ability to take?
Take or lose?
Oh, either way.
I once saw a $4 billion loss from a scenario. It wasn't actually, it wasn't enacted, but it was an exercise, a scenario analysis exercise to say, if this happened, how much would we lose? $4 billion. That is the biggest number that came to mind when you asked that question. And right. Actual loss for fraud, I've seen $2 million where somebody got themselves hired in a financial wire transfer department, got in, made the couple of wire transfers, disappeared, and was never seen again.
Only $2 million. All right. So, yeah. You know, we're, you know, a little bit. So I just, for calibration, my record was $40
billion. Oh, God.
and this, when you say scenario, what we used to do is make them tap out.
Okay.
So we would always have somebody from their side with us, because right. Otherwise it's not safe or, you know, for anybody, and you have liability and all sorts of stuff. We got to the point where you said, so just so we understand, you agree, if I press enter now, then $40 billion disappears and goes into whatever account I want to send it to. Is that correct? Yes, it is. Okay. Can we undo this? I'm not going to touch the keyboard. So you can you undo this so we don't not in that situation? Sure, absolutely. Okay. So she found out about the problem, told her boss, who said, tell that person. That person tried to do what they could, but it didn't work. And the whole thing fell anyway. Is that not the story of every cybersecurity person who finds things and tries to tell management about it that you've ever heard or experienced?
Oh, certainly the vast majority, right? You know, this is where policy hacking gets really interesting, you know, almost philosophical, right? You know, this, again, my favorite Mark Twain story of the two little boys, the terrible little boy who grows up, marries well, and dies rich and happy, right? You know, because I it sounds like to the people responsible, they're actually went on and things were fine. And often enough, you can make all the wrong choices, but you were only CEO, you know, for 3 years or 7 years is a stepping stone to the next job and everything else. And as long as it doesn't happen under your watch, you're golden. And you actually are.
Golden is the correct word. Yes.
Right. So we're rewarding, you know, not doing
it. Yes, rewarding failure, but punishing. In many cases, look, there are plenty of people at lower levels that, you know that things are bad and don't call it out and keep their jobs. And mostly the people that call out the problems lose their jobs. And I'm not sure that that's a wrong thing in the sense that most people at that level, at the lower levels, don't actually know the basis for the risk management decisions being made. So it might be that the company is well aware of it. You know, yeah, yes, we understand, but it's not a big deal. So, yes, we plan on losing $100,000 every year from this, and that's fine. Because, you know, the alternative is to spend $1 million to protect it, right?
Right. You know, in the industrial security space, you know, I always think about this because, you know, at BorderWare in the early 90s, you know, the very first conference, someone said, I've got an oil refinery. What does your firewall do for me? And the answer was nothing. Not a lot of that going on right now. I can't put people on it, you know, to develop that esoteric little weirdness when Wall Street is buying everything we can do. And same thing in 2000, you know, at Cisco with when Jennifer's at Bear Stearns, right? You know, the oil refinery, you know, you're Cisco, you got all this power. Can you add industrial protocols to your firewall? No, can't. You know, sometimes the pragmatic realities are that the things that need to be done can't be done now.
Right. Well, the other thing is the oil company didn't say, I'll tell you what, we'll pay you $10 billion to do it. And if they did, you probably all of a sudden maybe could have figured out, yeah, we'd be happy to.
Well, but this is the complexity of it, because if that oil company did and the other oil company didn't, you know, the first oil company now has $1 billion in extra expenses that their competitors don't.
No, 10 billion.
There you go.
Yeah, right. But, you know, they don't actually care about those expenses because, you know, they write them off as some lease thing, you know, who knows?
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on The Cyber Show, John all of a sudden gets reasonable and prudent. Talk about diligence. Jennifer gets off the road and goes for the big bucks and gets them. Roger tries to do a Daniel Webster and spin his way out of death and succeeds. For now,
A new pitch playing with the keys, but will it unlock a fortune? More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.